It's the rat line that concerns us for the rest of this show. And if you have always been a little confused as to exactly how Adolf Hitler died, was it cyanide in the Berlin bunker? Was it a bullet? Was it a gun that was held in his mouth, that he put the gun up to his temple and the body was burned, right? But then later on, didn't the Russians come out and prove that that was Adolf Hitler's body that they'd had for all those years? No, none of those things are true. Fascinating to hear. We'll start right there. What actually did happen in the Berlin bunker that leads Peter Lavenda all the way to Singapore to be photographed in front of a grave of a man that very likely could have been Adolf Hitler, who lived to a very old natural age. Onto his second wife, perhaps his third even. We'll tell you more about that coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. I emailed Peter Lavenda, I think about three chapters into Ratline. I told him I thought this is his best book yet, and I have read many. Unholy Alliance is a Coast to Coast classic, and Peter Lavenda is out with a new one. And I was trying to find a good way to describe it. First of all, good evening, Peter.
Good evening. Good to hear you.
Good to hear you, as always. I was trying to think of a good way to describe it, that in a way, what you did with Ratline was you took a piece that was written by somebody, a small piece that was written by somebody else in a foreign country, an article, and you vetted it to try to prove whether or not that person could have been right. And along the way, uncovered much more than that original writer could have known. Fair enough?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. It was an article written for a magazine in Indonesia in 1983, and it was just a vague mention of something that got my interest, and it set me off on this wild ride of the last year or so trying to uncover the truth about what this man was writing about, and it's an incredible story for sure.
Well, and it's not a wild goose chase, which is what I really love about what you do and how I always talk about your work, so well documented, and the fact that you don't just piece this together by going online. You get in planes, you travel into difficult places, you have sometimes life-threatening encounters as you try to find out what can be known about the subject. In this case tonight, it's the disappearance of Adolf Hitler. So let's start with the Berlin bunker first. And there's lots of ways we could get into the story, but I think it's important to address right away the myth of the death of Adolf Hitler.
Yes, it's the part that I had the most trouble with, really, because I was invested in the idea that Hitler committed suicide on April 30th, 1945. I wrote about it in Unholy Alliance. I wrote about the significance of that day for German paganism, for instance. So I had never questioned the idea that Hitler died in the bunker on that day, committing suicide, shot himself through the head, and took the cyanide capsule simultaneously. This was something I took for granted, and I think most people do. So when I heard a rumor this might not have been the case, I went back and I researched considerably what really took place at that time. What was the story? And the story we've been told is the cover story written by a man called Hugh Trevor Roper, very famous British historian, who at that time was a major in the MI6, in the Secret Intelligence Service, British intelligence, during World War II. And he was tasked with this idea. He was tasked by his commanding officer, Dick White, who said, you've got to go out and prove that Hitler committed suicide in the bunker. You've got 3 months to do this. We know you don't speak German. Doesn't matter. Go out and prove that he died, because the Russians are saying we're protecting him, that we managed to allow him to escape. So you have 3 months, prove that he died. In other words, begin from a conclusion and work your way backwards.
Right.
So This is the story we've been told, the famous story of the bunker. There's a handful of Nazis still left. The bombs are falling. The Russians are coming into Berlin. It's only a matter of hours before the entire city is under Russian occupation. Hitler sees the time has come. The end is near. It's Gitterdammerung. He marries Eva Braun, his longtime mistress. The day before, they have a brief wedding ceremony. And then the next day, April 30th, around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Eva Braun takes a cyanide capsule. Hitler chews on a cyanide capsule and simultaneously shoots himself in the head. The shot is heard, or the smoke from the pistol is smelled, depends on who you talk to. They break open the door, and there's Hitler and Eva Braun dead on a sofa. That's the story we've been told.
We should step in there and say that's part of that's unusual already because they were in a soundproof bunker, right? I mean, so
correct.
That thing you mentioned about the gun, smelling the gun smoke under the door, they would have had to have smelled that because it would be almost impossible to think they would have heard a gunshot through that type of a room, the way the room was laid out.
That's correct. I mean, it was intended, excuse me, to be soundproof. It was an underground bunker. The idea was to keep it soundproof, to keep it quiet. This is where the command center of the Third Reich was in the last few months of the war. So, yes, they were very thick doors, very heavy steel reinforced doors. There was no way to hear a gunshot, but most of the eyewitnesses, who, by the way, were virtually all SS officers or members of Hitler's personal staff, came up with the story. They heard a gunshot. They opened the door, and they found Hitler had committed suicide. Surprise, surprise. This is the story we've been told.
Right.
And then we've been told that the body of Hitler and the body of Eva Braun were brought upstairs to the open air in front of the bunker to a kind of garden area and were cremated. And the bodies left in a kind of crater. And depending upon who you talk to, this story changes considerably. All of the SS officers who were involved in this tell a different story. Some were in captivity by the Soviets. They told the Soviets one story. Those in captivity by the British told the British a different story, told Trevor Roper a different story. In fact, told Trevor Roper several different stories. He sort of cherry-picked the one he liked best. The Soviets were doing the same thing on their side. The Americans, to a certain extent, on their side. So suddenly, as I'm looking at all of this, I'm realizing that the eyewitness testimony doesn't match. It's all contradictory. Everybody's telling a different story. Even the SS under Soviet control, who were being tortured for their stories, were telling the Soviets different stories. I mean, they kept changing the story every time the interrogation started. So we really don't know from the eyewitness testimony. So we're reduced to the forensic testimony. We're reduced to what forensics existed, what autopsies, what forensic data was available to prove that Hitler and Eva Braun were dead and that the Russians had the bodies. And
all right, Yeah, let's take a breath there because I think there's so much more to unpack about what you have already talked about. So there were so many different witnesses, all Germans, some of whom were in Hitler's inner circle, each of whom might have been claiming they were steps away from the suicide when it happened, each of whom have a different story.
Yes.
I mean, that's the part that's so remarkable. You have somebody who is his driver, somebody who is a high-ranking Nazi official who was there. Where were the highest-ranking Nazis that were in the bunker? Where were they when the Führer's body was discovered? And nobody seems to remember exactly the same thing, and their versions of the story are so dramatically different, including the idea of the burial of the bodies, like taking the bodies up and then dousing them with gasoline and lighting them on fire. Because even that in and of itself would not have, let's talk about the condition of the bodies that were found as a way of getting into the forensics, but that the varying testimony about who did that type of street side cremation, that's key to understanding whether or not that was really Hitler's body.
Well, that's true. In the first place, there were several different stories as to the conditions of the bodies that were brought out of the bunker to be cremated. Nobody remembers the same story. Nobody remembers who was present. All of the testimony as to who was present during the cremation is different. Everybody tells a different story. In some cases, a virtual procession of SS men and high-ranking Nazis, including Bormann, present at the scene of the cremation. In others, there's only two guys there, you know, and it's kind of a secret thing. They douse a couple of cans of gasoline onto the body, set it afire, and walk away. In other cases, it's practically a Wagnerian funeral. Everybody you talk to told a different story. And these guys would change their stories depending upon who asked them and when they were asked. So we really don't have any kind of coherent testimony, not even as to where the bodies were located or where they had been left, how much gasoline was used. Was it a real cremation, or they just charred the flesh of the bodies, to be graphic about it? Was Eva Braun wearing her trademark blue velvet dress? Was Hitler wearing socks? You know, there's all sorts of strange stories. You know, even Hitler's clothing at one point appeared to be patched and ragged in one story, but was impeccable in another story. So everybody had a different version of the cremation itself, not to mention the actual condition of the bodies. The most famous story about the bodies, they open the door, Bormann opens the door, according to one story, and there's Hitler sort of slumped on the couch. He's got a tiny red wound that one witness said looked as if it had been painted on his temple. On his shoulder, resting against his shoulder, is the body of Eva Braun, who has taken cyanide. It's a very peaceful, loving tableau, it would appear to be, except that it's impossible under the circumstances. Right. If Eva Braun had taken cyanide, she would have been in convulsions. She would have been writhing on the floor. She would not have been gently leaning up against Hitler. That's not possible, number one.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like a potion like you'd hear about in a like a fairy tale. If that's how you really died from cyanide, you fell over and you went.
Exactly right. In fact, that's what the British intelligence called this mission of Hugh Trevor Roper. It was called Operation Nursery.
How about that?
As if you're telling a fairy tale to children, and that's really right. What it is. So there's Eva. That story makes no sense in the first place.
Right.
In the second place, there's stories that Hitler had Parkinson's disease. It was never diagnosed, and yet people said, well, he had tremors in his hands. Well, if he had tremors in his hands, was he able to simultaneously bite down on a cyanide capsule and then shoot himself in the head, which was the standard story that Trevor Roper put out? It seems to me to be physically impossible. And at the same time, put together with Eva Braun's suicide, which is this gentle, like a magic potion, as you say, death, that's also, I mean, impossible. The whole scenario, the whole tableau is unreal. I mean, forensically, medically, no matter how you look at it, could not have happened that way.
And yet that's the story we've come to accept. And I think it's important, again, to point out that the original narrative of this appeared to be constructed to satisfy a political goal, which was to wrap up World War II with a bow, to say that, you know, to stand triumphant over the body of Adolf Hitler, which I think we can all chime with. I mean, that we understand the need to do that, but also then maybe to kind of take the teeth out of Stalin's bite, that he still had Hitler, he still knew of Hitler's whereabouts, and Hitler was alive, and that might have been Stalin's thumb in the eye to the Allies as a way of saying, you're not as you don't know what you think you know, and nobody should trust their leaders in the West.
Right. We can say that Stalin had an agenda, a political agenda. It's very possible that Stalin believed that Hitler was dead. The problem is we'll never know. He got Russian intelligence to go through cartwheels trying to prove that Hitler had actually died. He wanted definitive proof internally, which we found out later. At the time, CIA, in one of their analysis of this whole situation some years ago, said that Stalin was obviously playing a disinformation campaign on the West and was doing this for his own political purposes. But when Russian documentation surfaced in the last few years after the fall of the Soviet Union, we find out that Russian intelligence was desperate to prove to Stalin that Hitler had actually died. So internally, with Stalin and with Russian intelligence, with the KGB and with SMERSH and the NKVD, the Russian military secret service, nobody could prove for certain that Hitler had died, and they tried desperately. If they had found the bodies, as Russians claim they did, in the Reichschancellery garden in Berlin in May of 1945, if they had actually found those bodies, why were they constantly interrogating and torturing the SS men under their control to find out what really had happened to Hitler.
That's interesting.
There's two different things going on simultaneously.
Sure.
Somebody was very frightened that they didn't have the real bodies.
And there, but Stalin's not alone, because as you present in the book Ratline, and again we're talking with Peter Lavenda, there was great concern, at least by the FBI and maybe for a period of time by the CIA, that they didn't believe the official British version of Adolf Hitler's death.
No, I mean, they knew it was a British intelligence operation. I mean, they knew that Trevor Roper worked for MI6, and they knew this, the backstory for this thing. Eisenhower's people were noncommittal on the subject. They didn't want to be pressured into giving one statement or another. Eisenhower initially didn't believe that Hitler had died. His chief of staff made a statement to the press that he didn't die. And Hoover demanded information from his people all over the world that any Hitler sightings be sent to him directly and immediately. He was extremely interested for decades after the war in Hitler sightings. It was not a question of, let's file the Hitler sighting in the Hitler sighting file, you know, along with Elvis and everything else. This was a desperation on the part of Hoover, who really wanted to know the truth and who never trusted the story given by the British that Hitler had died, you know, committed suicide in the bunker. Otherwise, he wasted, you know, a lot of money, a lot of resources in hunting down all of these Hitler sightings, particularly in South America. And the declassified FBI files are there. Anybody can take a look and read them. And some of them make for some fascinating reading, knowing today, you know, what we know now, what we did not know then, as far as the forensics having been so horribly botched, dental work and the bodies being ridiculous, and all the other evidence they gave being laughable.
Well, Yeah, let's hold it right there, because we'll need a little bit more time to talk about the dental work, and then how the Soviets appeared to be gaming the system years later, when they sort of pulled that skull out of the box and tried to reaffirm that they in fact had Hitler. We'll get back to that, because meanwhile, there are other people out there. This brings us back to the original article. There are other people out there who say that they had met Adolf Hitler, and that he was a senior citizen. He was getting on quite nicely, lived very comfortably, and he was living in Singapore. It sounds incredible. But then just go back and think about what Peter Lavenda has already been talking about. How is it possible that there's so many versions of the death of Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun? How is that possible if they're all in the same confined space and there were so few of them? How could none of them have their stories? In some ways, how could their stories all be completely different? And then you go to coasttocoastam.com tonight. You go to the part about Peter Lavenda being on, and you see the related story link. Go look at Adolf Hitler, if he had wanted to disguise himself at the end of the war, just by changing his glasses and his mustache, or even his hairline. Go see that. Put it up right now at coasttocoastam.com. Kind of a coincidence that those photographs should appear while I'm reading Ratline, but it couldn't be better for tonight's show. We'll talk about how Adolf Hitler escaped the bunker and how he made it to Singapore coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. We're talking about Ratline, Soviet spies and Nazi priests. If you go to click on that link that we put up at coasttocoastam.com with the different photographs of what Hitler would have looked like if Hitler had wanted to disguise himself to get out of Germany, I think you get a better idea, in a way, of what every intelligence organization is up against. If somebody has the wherewithal to hide themselves. There are lots of times when somebody big and tall like Osama bin Laden, you know, very likely should have been caught and or killed many times before he actually was, no doubt about that. But for somebody of an average height, somebody who could keep changing their appearance like other members of Al-Qaeda, you know, they can stay on the run for a very long time if they want to. And there have been some stories recently about some of the people that we've been searching for internationally for years. Well, the same was true with Adolf Hitler. The Ratline, Soviet spies, Nazi priests, and the disappearance of Adolf Hitler tracks that story. We'll get back to it, too. And I have been told that if you want to go click on the story of that I wrote about a Coast to Coast listener and the positive impact they had on my tinnitus. You can go take a look at that. The story is up. It was in the cover of Tinnitus Today magazine. Earlier tonight, it may have crashed. The server might have crashed from people trying to get on all at once, but no problem getting on right now. And thank you, whoever notified me of that, at my Twitter account, at Deacon Punnett, DEACONPUNNETT. We can talk during the week, too, especially about this show, which I think is going to change your belief of what happened after the end of World War II, and maybe also perhaps finally get a couple of those currently redacted documents released to the American public. Documents which, for some reason right now, are still blocked out at the highest levels of our intelligence. Documents that Peter Lavenda could not get his hands on, which might explain the whole thing. We'll tell you more about that coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So we're talking with Peter Lavenda, author of Rat Line, Soviet Spies, Nazi Priests, and the Disappearance of Adolf Hitler. We were talking about the forensic evidence, and I mentioned there just before the break how there are still documents, U.S. documents, that are so heavily redacted as to be pointless. What would we possibly be hiding from researchers like you all these many years later about the death of Adolf Hitler?
Well, it's one of the things that's obsessed me. I mean, how can you still have documents that are classified 60, 70 years after the fact? I mean, people's names are being hidden, locations are being hidden under those redactions, and in some cases, entire pages are redacted. I mean, the FBI files that were declassified recently, the Adolf Hitler files, contain pages and pages that are completely blacked out. And it doesn't make any sense anymore. I mean, the war has been over for a very long time. The only thing you could possibly keep hidden would be some very serious information about operational stuff where the FBI was concerned as far as how close they got to Hitler, or, you know, Hitler's location, or perhaps information from the immigration authorities from the various countries in which they were looking for Hitler, like Argentina, most famously. So yeah. There's something in there. I mean, there's obviously stuff they're still hiding 70 years later. So naturally, I want to get my hands on what that is, but that's been so far impossible.
So the Soviets supposedly have the body. They take it. They say years later, they even have this famous press conference where they have they've performed forensic tests on the remains. And they confirm that the remains that they rescued outside of the Berlin bunker back in 1945 were, in fact, Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun. What's wrong with that theory?
Well, the Soviets' own documentation puts the lie to that. The Soviets, there was an organization called SMERSH, Death to Spies, right? This was the famous SMERSH of Ian Fleming and James Bond days. SMERSH was a military intelligence, counterintelligence operation. They were the first ones to get to the Reichschancellery in Berlin. They were the ones charged with finding Hitler's body and Eva Braun's body. Okay, after a couple of days and all sorts of interrogations, they find this guy, this SS officer, who leads them to this pit where the bodies are supposed to be found. Well, the first day, they don't find it. The second day, he changes slightly his direction and finds the bodies. They're very happy. They dig up these bodies. They're charred. They have false teeth dentures placed in each one, Eva's and Hitler's. On the basis of the dentures, not the conditions of the bodies, but the dentures themselves, they say, okay, these dentures fit what we know of Hitler's dentures. Therefore, this is Hitler in the grave, and this is Eva Braun because we have her dentures too. So the dentures are the key element of this story of identifying the bodies. The problem is, the dentures don't fit the mouths of the people in which they've been inserted. That's problem number one. In Ava's case, they were just thrown into the skull. I mean, they weren't really fitted into her mouth.
They didn't pull them off of the teeth of the skull. They're just in a box with the stuff.
Well, they are today. But when they found the bodies, when they actually found the bodies to do the autopsies, I mean, it was noted in their autopsy report that the dentures were loose in the mouths of both of these people. Huh. Eva Braun's body also bore shrapnel wounds that had bled. Now, if Eva Braun had committed suicide in the bunker and her body was brought out and then hit by shrapnel. She would not have bled. Dead bodies don't bleed. But she had shrapnel wounds that had bled. Plus, there was some cyanide capsule in the mouth of this corpse that they thought was Eva Braun. But there was no presence of cyanide anywhere in the internal organs. So somebody had just broken the cyanide capsule in the mouth of a woman's dead body. And that they called Eva Braun. And in Hitler's case, a very similar situation. A partially cremated body. The only thing they had were dentures. The dentures were created by his personal dentist. However, the dental technician is the one who created the drawings of the dentures from memory for the Soviets, which is almost an impossible thing anyway. So he writes this, he draws this drawing. It miraculously fits the dentures they found. And they say, okay, good, we've got Hitler. But what do? They have Hitler and Eva Braun. They should be having a press conference and showing to the world, we've got their bodies. Instead, they take the bodies, put them in a truck, the Russians, and they drive around East Germany, or what is today East Germany, with the bodies of Hitler and Eva Braun. They bury the bodies. They dig them up again a few days later, drive them someplace else, bury the bodies again, dig them up again a total of four times. They are burying and digging up and reburying these two bodies. And this wandering through Germany with the bodies makes no sense whatsoever.
But isn't the explanation that they just don't want people to know where they're buried, and as soon as people start to catch on that's where they're buried, they're going to move them again because they don't want to create a shrine?
No, I understand not creating a shrine, but there's a simple solution to that. Destroy the bodies.
Right.
You know, burying them and then digging them up again in remote locations. I mean, they're talking about in the forest. I mean, some of the directions to finding the bodies were arcane. Bury under this particular tree. There's three trees here. You drive to this highway. You turn off this way. I mean, they really chose remote places to bury them. Until at the end, they bring them to Magdeburg in Germany, where the Russian secret police at that time has an installation. And they bury the bodies in the courtyard of this building. And it's not just Hitler and Eva Braun. It's the entire Goebbels family, which is Hitler's the chief propagandist, the guy in charge of all the propaganda for Germany. He, his wife, and their six children, and their little dog, too, were all buried in this grave, along with General Krebs, who was one of the last people there, and Hitler and Eva Braun. All of these bodies are buried in this grave in Magdeburg, and then paved over and forgotten about until 1970.
So let's pause there for 1970. We'll come back to that because it's what they do with the bodies after 1970, which also seemed to be the behavior in and of itself seems to be suspicious. And let's pick up then the original impetus for the story was this article written back in 1983 and published in a fairly kind of obscure magazine, right? It wasn't exactly like wasn't picked up by Time or Newsweek back in 1983, was it?
No. This was in an Indonesian magazine, and it was in the Indonesian language, and it was written by a doctor, an Indonesian doctor, who claims that a man he ran into in 1960 on a remote island in Indonesia was actually Hitler. And he based this assumption on the fact that the physical characteristics of the person he met matched exactly what he read about in another magazine article. That was written by one of Hitler's so-called eyewitnesses. His personal pilot, Hans Bauer, had written what had happened to the body, what Hitler looked like, et cetera, the last days of the bunker and all of this. The doctor was reading it just, you know, for entertainment purposes, read the article and recognized, in his words, he recognized that this could have been Hitler that he saw on that remote island. So he starts making some phone calls. And he finds out that this guy, this German doctor, as he called him, that he met on the island of Sumbawa Besar in Indonesia. We're talking remote. We're talking east of Java, east of Bali, east of Lombok. We're talking in the middle of nowhere. There's a doctor running a hospital and a clinic. So he makes phone calls to see if he can locate this guy to talk to him and finds out that he died in 1970. In January, late January of 1970, in the city of Surabaya, in Indonesia. And at that point, it seems as if the story has gone cold, except he finds out that the doctor had married an Indonesian woman a couple of years before he died. and the Indonesian woman had possession of the old man's personal papers, including a diary written in German shorthand. And that's what got me going, because when I saw that article, the Indonesian doctor mentions that one name, Krunoslav Draganovich, mentioned in this diary, written before the guy died in 1970, and that set off alarm bells. That is the point when I started to take the story seriously, because Krunoslav Draganovich was the man who created the rat line, and he was nowhere a famous person in 1970 or before.
I think that's really one of the most interesting smoking guns. So I want to go back and I want to amplify that again. So this guy writes an article in 1983 talking about something that he experienced back before in the 60s, and then sort of researching it. And in researching it, you know, it just bugged him all these years about this guy that he had run into, this German doctor who was running a clinic in the middle of nowhere with his German wife, and then he researches further, because it just bugs him that there's this guy doing that, and the local townspeople were very proud of the fact that they had a European-trained doctor, right? I mean, they weren't, exactly. they had no idea it was Adolf Hitler.
No.
And so he writes an article in 1983 about his experiences that happened before, but in doing so, he uncovers this diary that the German doctor had been writing about, and in this German diary, he mentions some key names in what we now know as the people that were involved in the rat line, people that got high-ranking Nazis out of Germany for a fee, people that were then, you know, brought along because of their prestige within the party or because of their money, and brought to safety in Argentina, or as we later discover, into Asia as well. And it was that name in that diary. So you have to explain what is significant about that father's name.
Well, when I was researching Unholy Alliance back in the day, some time ago now, almost 20 years, I came across the name Draganovich. It was very important. This was a Roman Catholic Monsignor, a Croatian priest. For your listeners, Croatia during World War II was extremely pro-Nazi. They had a political party called the Ustashi, and these guys were rabid pro-Nazis, rabid anti-communists, rabid anti-Semites. When Croatia fell, as the British and the communist partisans began to take the country away from the Nazis, the first order of priority for this priest was to get the leadership of Croatia out of Europe and to safety in South America. So he essentially single-handedly created what they call the monastery route of the rat line, which is passing these wanted war criminals from church to church, monastery to monastery, religious building to religious building, to get them all the way to Genoa and to give them fake papers. They couldn't travel under their own names, of course. So they got fake identification from the Vatican, and they got fake passports from the International Red Cross, and they got visas that Draganovich himself managed to arrange with Argentina, and he got virtually the entire leadership of the Croatian puppet government, the Nazi puppet government, out of Europe and to South America. He started by doing that, and then he became indispensable when the Allies took over, when they defeated Germany in the war. This guy, Draganovich, was based in Austria, in Salzburg, and he was working with American CIC, that's the Counterintelligence Corps of the U.S. Army, based in Salzburg, and he was helping them to ferret out other Nazis that they could possibly use in the war against the Soviet Union, in the fight against communism. So suddenly Draganovich, who's protecting Nazis and letting them escape for his own political purposes, now has benefactors in the person of American intelligence who have decided maybe we want these guys, their networks, their understanding of the Soviet systems of communism, maybe we want to save them. So he starts now by saving them under the aegis of American intelligence. And that's the rat line. That's how these guys escaped. They escaped with Draganovich. But nobody knew the name Draganovich back in 1960 or even in 1970, unless you were a Nazi hunter or were specifically involved in this. And it shows up in the diary, not only the name Draganovich, but a number of important addresses in Italy, one of which appeared nowhere else in any of the literature I've been able to find, in any documents anywhere, an address of the German Archaeological Institute in Rome, and that opened up an entire new area of inquiry and investigation, because none of the Nazi hunters that I know, and none of the books that I've read or the files that I've seen, mention the connection of the German Archaeological Institute, and yet this bizarre information is contained in that diary, and it's contained only as an address. It doesn't say German Archaeological Institute. I had to find that out myself as to who was headquartered in that particular address in Rome in 1945, and it turned out that's who they were. So that made me believe this diary is genuine. Whoever had that diary was a Nazi on the run, and they used the rat line because they could not use their own names or their own paperwork to get out of Europe.
You're just getting kind of honestly just some of the bullet points. Peter Levende goes into great detail, but fascinating detail on the rat line. Who were the Nazi priests that were providing cover for this this escape route? Who were the main beneficiaries? Where did the gold go? How did they get it there? These are some of the aspects of the rat line, because it was very important first to get the sort of the advanced troops, as it were, into wherever they were headed, then to get the gold there. Once they had somebody to watch over it, then to get the gold there so that they could use that to prop up local governments and to buy their way into freedom. And after they got the gold there, then to bring in kind of the rock stars of the Nazi Party, once they knew it was going to be a soft landing, to get them out and transfer them. Do I have the sequence roughly right?
Absolutely. I mean, this was more than just helping a bunch of criminals escape. This wasn't like a prison break. This was much more elaborate than that and had been planned in advance in order to reconstitute the Third Reich outside of Europe if necessary and to keep the war going. That's basically all that happened, is they shifted the battle, the scene of the theater of battle, away from Europe and to the Middle East and to Latin America, to Asia. What they were doing is keeping their operation going. These were true believers. These people didn't give up just because they lost the war.
And these true believers in the Nazi cause then end up working for people like the Juan Perón, the eventual president of Argentina. End up working for these other governments around South America. Some of the most hunted Nazis end up living out very long, happy lives entirely on their own recognizance. Some of them without even really changing significant details about their name. They just seem to be forgotten about. And so maybe that is another way of looking at how Adolf Hitler could have made it along the rat line from Berlin into Singapore. But in order to get more of that story out here, we have to talk about who those bodies were then that the Soviets took, and what was the identity that Adolf Hitler traveled under and lived out the rest of his life as. Who is the guy that Peter Levende then is posed in front of at coasttocoastam.com on the website? Go take a look at that, and we'll tell you more about the Soviet spies, the Nazi priests, and Adolf Hitler all along the rat line on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.